Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over five recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top five countdown for the week. At number five, we have Ethiopia's proposal to mediate the lingering dispute between its Eritrean and Djiboutian neighbors as Addis Ababa takes the lead in pioneering peace in the Horn of Africa. The brief 2008 border conflict between these two tiny, impoverished, but strategically positioned Red Sea states had previously seen the UN-mandated intervention of Qatari peacekeepers along their disputed frontier, but the Gulf state soldiers pulled out of the region last year after both countries leaned closer to Saudi Arabia during the ongoing Gulf Cold War. Abu Dhabi has since established itself as a trans-regional power by facilitating the historic peace agreement between Ethiopia and Eritrea, and it can be speculated, possibly even the rapprochement between Ethiopia and close Emirati partner Egypt. But now it's Ethiopia's turn to broker regional reconciliation because of the UAE's recent loss of influence in Djibouti. A fast-moving dispute earlier this year saw the Djiboutian government seize control of an Emirati-operated port, thereby making the Gulf state powerless to shape events in the country, for better or for worse. Djibouti has also raised concern over the past month that Eritrea is being prematurely welcomed back into the international community, despite no progress being made on resolving the two countries' decade-long border issue, though some analysts believe that it's more fearful of losing its transit monopoly over Ethiopia to Addis Ababa's previously sworn enemy than anything else. As the thinking goes, this is also being encouraged by the UAE for retributive reasons. Ethiopia naturally has an interest in diversifying its access to the sea, but it doesn't have to be framed in the zero-sum way that some in Djibouti might be interpreting it. Even so, the successful rerouting of some trade from Djibouti to Eritrea and the breakaway region of Somaliland, in which Ethiopia and the UAE plan to jointly develop a port, would inevitably have an impact on the volume of trade across the newly opened and Chinese-financed Djibouti-Addis Ababa Railway, therefore possibly leading to less-than-expected revenues that ultimately offset Djibouti's long-term budgetary planning. It goes without saying that this would also adversely affect China's commercial interests as well. It's this second-mentioned tangential consequence that has caused some people to fret that Ethiopia is doing the U.S. a strategic bidding, but that's unjustified fear-mongering. Because a superficial correlation between the two doesn't mean that one caused the other, nor that it's even an accurate way to interpret the latest developments. The UAE and India recently agreed to closely cooperate with one another in Africa, meaning that the Emirates could contribute to funding the Indo-Japanese Asia-Africa Growth Corridor and helping it establish a foothold in the UAE's new sphere of influence over the Horn of Africa. But the successful application of Beijing's latest China-India Plus One proposal for coordinating developmental policies in African states could offset any zero-sum consequences. For that to happen, though, Djibouti needs to avoid replacing Eritrea as the regional pariah and reach a mutually acceptable settlement with its neighbor. The Horn of Africa is on the cusp of profound change that could soon see more comprehensive Ethiopian-led integrational proposals, such as streamlining economic and trade coordination with the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, and eventually pairing the bloc with the East African Community, for example. But this exciting future requires that all players get on board, and that no one plays a spoiler, which is why it's so important for the Eritrean-Djiboutian dispute to be resolved as soon as possible. Otherwise, Chinese, and consequently multipolar, interest will be jeopardized. The next one up is the Pakistani Navy beginning regional maritime security patrols in the northwestern corner of the Indian Ocean. The initiative started last month and has since seen the country's ships pay visits to Saudi Arabia and Oman, thereby broadening the scope of Pakistani influence in the emerging multipolar world order. The patrols are fully in line with international law and are designed to establish symbolic presence along the sea lines of communication between CPEC's terminal port of Gwadar and the emerging markets of the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden region, especially in the Horn of Africa, that will be connected with China through this route. This in turn could serve as the prelude to stronger economic ties between Pakistan and its relevant partners, because the organic outgrowth of closer Navy-to-Navy cooperation could predictably see the clinching clinching of commercial deal, as Islamabad learns to leverage its irreplaceable transit role along CPEC and protection of its sea lines of communication to the advantage of its domestic entrepreneurs. It's not only China and Pakistan that have an economic interest in this part of the world, but also their Indo-Japanese rivals, the first mention of whom could now theoretically use the French military facilities in Djibouti, following the signing of a Lamoa-like logistics agreement with it earlier this year, and also those in Oman's Duka after a similar pact, while the second already has a base in Djibouti. Not only that, but India's new strategic partners in the UAE vowed to cooperate with it in Africa, which could boost the joint Indo-Japanese-Asia-Africa growth corridor's applicability through an added influx in financing. Moreover, Abu Dhabi is already a trans-regional power in the Horn of Africa and has established military bases in Eritrea, South Yemen and its nearby island of Socotra, and the breakaway region of Somaliland. The Pakistani Navy is therefore just the latest party to express an interest in these waterways and the hinterland markets that their terminal port lead to, thus confirming the trend that the center of naval gravity is shifting in the direction of the Horn of Africa because of strategic economic reasons. The deepening South-South integration between Asian and African economies is one of the defining features of the 21st century, so it makes sense that military strategies will be formulated around it. Due to simple geographic and demographic factors, Africa's second most populous country and its fastest growing economy of Ethiopia is expected to be the first real battleground of competitive connectivity between the Silk Road and the Asia-Africa growth corridor, which explains why countries such as Pakistan are beginning to express interest in the Horn of Africa as they scope out future business opportunities. Third on our countdown are Ecuador's plans to allow the U.S. to open up a so-called security cooperation office in the South American state. RT reported that the Ecuadorian defense minister confirmed this latest development late last week and wrote that it represents a policy reversal from previous President Rafael Correa's administration, which refused to renew the U.S.'s lease in La Manta Air Base and later amended the Constitution to prohibit the hosting of four military bases in general. The country's new defense authorities denied that this new initiative was unconstitutional by pointing to the proposed non-permanent presence of U.S. forces and the fact that the Ecuadorian Air Force would be managing this intelligence-sharing program. But critics are correct in claiming that this is yet another American power play in the continent. The U.S.'s successful hemisphere-wide pushback against the so-called pink tide of the mid-2000s can be described in old Cold War terms as an Operation Condor 2.0 that relies on shadowy means such as constitutional coups and hybrid wars to reverse the regional progress that was made in restoring Latin America's sovereignty, including in Ecuador. In that tiny coastal country, the U.S. somehow or another co-opted President Lenin Moreno, despite the original expectations of him being the torchbearer of Correa's multipolar legacy. This has since seen Quito supposedly enter into secret talks with Washington over the fate of whistleblower Julian Assange, and now the proposed establishment of the Security Cooperation Office. Ecuador, in and of itself, isn't all that important of a country despite its moderate oil reserves and recent history of being a gateway for Chinese influence into the region, but symbolically represents the first victory that the U.S. has achieved in taking over one of the members of the multipolar Venezuelan-led ALBA bloc. The Bolivarian Republic and its close Nicaraguan partner are both struggling against ever-intensifying hybrid wars, while Cuba has had to deal with incessant pressure against its economy. Landlocked Bolivia appears to be the next target in the run-up to President Morales' re-election campaign next year, but in the meantime, it's fair to say that Ecuador has, for all intents and purposes, become an American vassal state. This endangers ALBA's unity and overall cohesiveness as a stabilizing force of multipolar change in the continent, and it also represents an unexpected historical quirk because of how counterintuitive it is that a man named after Lenin would so closely collaborate with America on this neo-imperial scheme. It's been revealed in the week and a half since their deaths that they were officially in the war-torn country as tourists, but were secretly filming a documentary on Russia's private military companies there on behalf of former Russian oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who was previously jailed on corruption charges and then emigrated from Russia after its early release a few years ago. This wannabe opposition figure is obsessed with discrediting President Putin, and he apparently thought that one of the most creative ways to do so would be to expose the role of Russian PMCs in the Central African Republic, though nothing about Moscow's activities there are secret, let alone illegal. The United Nations Security Council granted Russia an exemption in December 2017 to export weapons to the country's armed forces and provide training to their military in order to help them reestablish control over this failed state, for which purpose Moscow committed 5 formal military advisors and 170 civilian trainers, the latter of which are presumably PMCs. All this information is a matter of public record, and there's nothing conspiratorial about it. But because PMCs are sometimes called mercenaries, and this reframing accordingly evokes very nefarious images, Hodorkovsky apparently thought that it would suffice as the subject of a documentary intended to cast a negative light on the Russian government's peacemaking activities in Africa. There's nothing inherently wrong with commissioning an investigative project on anything at all, but it must be carried out responsibly, which in this case, it wasn't. The three men didn't make the local Russian embassy aware of their presence in the country, nor did they apply for journalist credentials there. Instead, they sought to do everything in secret, which therefore put their lives in danger. It since emerged that they also dismissed the advice of local police officers who warned them against venturing beyond the capital at night, which they ended up doing anyhow and got killed because of it after they were stopped at a rebel roadblock and shot during a robbery. It would be unfair to render a verdict on the victim's judgment when it was Hodorkovsky's responsibility to ensure that they were properly trained and made aware of how to most safely conduct themselves in this very dangerous country. Their financier and project organizer should bear the blame for what happened. After commissioning them to clandestinely carry out journalistic activities there that were totally unnecessary because they weren't covering something that was secret. Russia civilian trainers in the Central African Republic are UN approved, but Hodorkovsky's conspiratorial suggestion that there might be something else going on regrettably led to irresponsible decisions that ultimately got them killed. Reuters reported that the proposal to cooperate on the repatriation of refugees and reconstruction projects in the Arab Republic was met with an icy reception by U.S. decision makers, though this could have been expected, considering that Washington had previously said that any assistance that it might provide to the government-controlled areas of Syria would be tied to the implementation of UNSC 2254's constitutional reform and new elections. Furthermore, President Assad declared in late June that his government would not accept reconstruction funds from the same countries that contributed to destroying his own, though if the leaked details of Gerasimov's message to Dunford are to be believed, then Russia's assessment is that Damascus, quote, lacks the equipment, fuel, other material, and funding needed to rebuild the country in order to accept refugee returns, end quote, hence the reason for reaching out to the U.S. Well, there were high hopes that Presidents Putin and Trump might have reached an understanding in Syria during last month's Helsinki summit. It appears as though expectations might be dashed after this latest setback. The U.S. veritably has an interest in focusing its reconstruction efforts and post-war development projects on the Kurdish-controlled proxy state in the northeastern agriculturally and energy-rich corner of the country that it's already deployed roughly 2,000 troops to. So there's a certain logic to rebuffing the latest Russian offer. Even though the Kurds in Damascus have reportedly entered into talks with one another, this is unlikely to lead to the dissolution of the U.S.'s protectorate, and we'll probably find a way to formalize it through mutually acceptable compromises that figure into the ongoing constitutional reform process. Although the leaking of Gerasimov's proposal to Dunford was probably done by Trump's deep state enemies in a desperate attempt to undermine what they may have feared was the president's secret deal with Putin, it inadvertently harms the U.S.'s soft power standing because it confirms that America doesn't really care about the welfare of the Syrian people or the return of refugees from the region and beyond, in spite of its repeated statements to the contrary over the years. Making humanitarian and developmental assistance conditional on political factors is Machiavellian to the core, but unsurprising to those who have a solid understanding of the cynicism behind American strategic planning. It's also proof that the U.S. is indirectly weaponizing refugees and developmental assistance in order to advance its objectives, something that its supporters have always denied, but which is now undebatable. All right, folks, so this wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for tuning into my program. Hope you all have a nice weekend, and tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.